All right, well, joining me on the line today is Matthew Stein. Matt is an engineering graduate of MIT, and he's the author of a best-selling book entitled When Technology Fails. He's also a guest columnist for the Huffington Post. Matt, thanks so much for joining me today on Follow the Money Weekly.
Well, thanks for having me on, Jerry. It's my pleasure.
You know, Matt, I recently had a chance to look over your book, When Technology Fails, and I have to admit, I was impressed. I mean, this book is not for the faint of heart. It's about 500 pages long, but I got to admit, it has a lot of pictures, so many people will enjoy that. And I tell you what, the information that you pack into this book covers a topic that few people today have really thought about deeply. That is, of course, as your title suggests, what would happen if technology were to fail? Why don't you begin by taking a minute to explain to our audience what this book that you have written is all about, and tell us why you wrote it.
Okay, well, the book is kind of split half and half. About half of the book is how to live more self-reliant, more sustainably, more healthily, while things in the world are still working well. And the other half of the book is how do you plan for and deal with varying levels of things not working so well in our world. Now, what does that mean? That could be anything from you had a major ice storm and the grid's down for a few days, a blizzard, a flood, a hurricane, to there's some terrorist act and the grid goes down for a while, or a natural act, you know, like we had in where the grid went down on the East Coast for several days due to thunderstorms in New York City and also due to problems at a different time, starting with a generating plant at Niagara Falls. So we see technology failures all the time in our world, but we're starting to stretch the natural systems of our world, and we're going to see increasing and more serious failures of technology. Now, people say, well, okay, what's an MIT engineer doing writing a book like this about failure of technology? Well, back in roughly 1997 Thanksgiving, I had a morning practice of daily prayer and meditation, and I sort of made a stupid request. I basically said, okay, could I have some guidance and inspiration here? Very generic request. And what happened was I got a bomb dropped in my lap on that particular morning. I basically received an instantaneous cosmic download, if you want to call it that, of a storyboard type of outline, sort of outlining in pictorial format my entire scope and breadth of this book. And my first thought, to be honest with you, was like, no way, I can't possibly do this. I don't know all this stuff. And the little voice in my head, some Jesus calls it the still small voice, basically assured me that nobody knew it all, and that I had the skills and talents that if I chose to take this on, this sort of task on, that I'd get the inner and outer help to make it happen, meaning intuitional guidance, and that with my dogged determination and MIT training and engineering background, I'd dig up all the experts and all the information I needed to fill in the holes and make the book happen. It actually took me 3 years from the bomb dropping in my lap till it was published, so it wasn't something where I just jumped up and said, you know, God talked to me today and I'm going to write this book. And it took me quite a while to decide maybe I could do it, and another year to sort of get a proposal and sell it to a publisher, and another year to rack up the credit cards and bite the bullet and really commit to doing it and work 70 hours a week and make it all happen.
Yeah, it takes a lot of work. Well, Matt, in the book you identified, and really the major theme here, are these six dangerous global trends, each of which are potential civilization busters, and that these trends may be forming into something of a perfect storm. Talk about these six trends and why people should care about them.
Okay, well, the six trends, each of which, like you say, are potential civilization busters. I'll just go through them quickly. And, you know, you may not believe in all of them, and it may be that one or two of these trends isn't really happening, though I personally believe they are. But all it takes is one or two of these trends to cause major problems in our civilization. We've got six of them. Okay, so the first major threat is climate change, and I don't always call it global warming. Sometimes I call it global weirding. And what we're seeing is that mankind's changing the parameters of the planet and the atmosphere and the forests and the oceans is causing disruptions in the stability of the weather systems on the planet. So overall, the data indicates it's warming, but we're also seeing instabilities all over, like worse floods, you know, worse droughts, worse heat waves, worse cold waves. It's just kind of like, it's like taking the shock absorbers out of your car and trying to drive around a bumpy, you know, twisty road without shock absorbers. You're going to have a terrible time trying to keep control over your car, and we're doing that to our weather systems. So that's number one. Number two is the peak in world oil production. And you say, well, okay, why is that a problem? Well, oil is what makes modern industrialized man's world go around. It flies our cars. Flies our planes, drives our cars. It powers the vehicles that grow our food. And there's processes that take hydrocarbons and make fertilizers. So they basically take natural gas and coal in China, natural gas in America, and they use that to make fertilizers. So it's not just oil that's going away. It's coal's going away, natural gas is going away. And you say, well, how bad a problem is this? Well, most governments have kind of poo-pooed this and said it's still decades out. But it turns out, according to the International Energy Agency, which a lot of governments of the world sort of plan their energy futures based on these recommendations, turns out that in 2006, we actually peaked in the world's oil production of regular sweet crude oil. Now, what does that mean to us? Well, back in the 1970s, people old enough to remember, they remember waking up early and parking cars in lines for gas rationing when the Arab oil embargo came in the United States. And they put the squeeze and only reduced the world oil production by 5%, and it caused a major crisis in our country, and it caused a financial depression in the world. Not as bad as the one we've been in lately, but it was pretty significant back then. And what we're seeing right now is that the world's oil production is decreasing at about 9% per year from the existing fields. And if you pump a lot of money into developing those fields, and it's only going down, and it's called enhanced oil production methods, then it's only dropping at 6% a year. Well, the problem is that we're not finding new oil fast enough to keep up with this depletion. So regular oil actually maxed out in 2006. And when you add in tar sands and biofuels, we're kind of just barely keeping our head above water right now. We're just sort of barely keeping up with this deflation in the amount of oil we're able to produce each year. And the problem is that decrease in production is accelerating, and the biofuels and tar sands, and there's nothing we're going to be able to do in another couple of years to keep up with that. And in fact, the U.S. military published a report last spring saying that as near as 2012 and as late as 2015, they're expecting crisis proportions in the world due to the oil depletion. And that was followed by a military report from Germany and a military report from the UK. So even though the big guns in government are still kind of like trying to keep the panic button, everyone away from the panic button and say everything's okay, the militaries of our countries are acknowledging that this is a problem that's in our face and that's coming right around the corner.
Matt, before you go to number three, I want to clarify two things about this or actually make a point as well. Number one, people sometimes, for some reason, they still get peak oil mixed up, and they actually think that peak oil means the world is running out of oil. And the proper definition, of course, as you point out in your book, is the fact that it's just simply running out of cheap, accessible oil. That's basically what we've been the beneficiaries of for so long. And now all of our infrastructure has been built upon this oil, this petroleum-based infrastructure. And now that the cheap, easy oil is so difficult to access, or is it getting more difficult to access, that's what peak oil is all about. You also make a point in the book about this idea of population. I'm sure you've seen the connection between the rise of the energy consumption, obviously, especially petroleum, and then the corresponding rise of the global population. Talk about that for a minute.
Well, population is actually the sixth of my six major threats. And just to give you a picture of what's happening in the world, people say, well, there's always been more people in the world. Well, from the time Jesus was born to the time Abraham Lincoln was born, fewer people were added to the planet than were added in the last 10 years. So imagine that. In 10 years' time, we've added more people in the last 10 years to our world than from the time Jesus walked the earth till the time Abraham Lincoln walked the earth.
Say that again.
We have added more people to our world in the last 10 years than were added to the world from the time Jesus walked the earth till the time Abraham Lincoln. 1,800 years of time from Jesus to Abraham Lincoln. We've added more people to our world in the last 10 years than were added in that 1,800. And by the end of 2011, from the beginning of the year 2000 till the end of 2011, we'll have added more people to our world than the entire population of the world 200 years ago. So in 11 years, we'll have added more people to the planet than everybody in the world just 200 years ago. So what that's doing, and not only are we adding more people to the world, see, the global footprint of the industrialized world in America, our global footprint right here versus, say, a typical African or Chinese worker, we use about 6 times as much natural resources for every single man, woman, and child in North America with our lifestyle than they do in China. So if you take the population of the world and you multiply it 7 times, which is what we've done since the year of 1800, and then you take the industrialized parts of the world and multiply those another 6 times, then you can see what the impact is on our world. And you can see that this is an accelerating curve that we just can't keep up. And the evidence is in the other factors that I'm talking about, in the other 6 trends. One, and you know, trend number three, is we're collapsing the world's oceans. We got 11 of 15 of the world's ocean fisheries are either in collapse or on the verge. The richest fishery in the world, George's Banks, off of Newfoundland, the northeastern part of the United States and Canada, dead, gone. Totally history. All those massive fishing fleets that used to fish that, they're out of business, so they've gone somewhere else in the world. And not only are we collapsing the fish in the oceans, we're changing the biochemistry of the oceans. We're acidifying it because all that carbon we put out in the atmosphere from burning all our fossil fuels, well, when the rain clouds come, they combine with that, it makes acid rain. It falls into the ocean, and it changes the pH of the acidity of the ocean. So what's that mean? Well, between 1960 and today, 73% of the world's zooplankton, that's like the bottom of the food chain in the ocean, gone away. Half of that has happened in the last decade. So what we're doing is we're changing the bottom of the food chain, and not only the food chain, it's part of the carbon-oxygen cycle that makes a breathable, livable atmosphere for human beings and mammals on the planet. It's like that developed over millions and hundreds of millions of years with carbon being stabilized and taken out of the atmosphere and making a breathable atmosphere for human beings. And when we're putting all this back in and we're destroying the planktons in the ocean and the fish in the ocean, we're disrupting this system that has help make a nice, livable planet for us human beings. Okay, so that's number three. Number four is the forests of the world. We've cut down half of the forests of the world, and most of that in the last 50 years. And you say, well, okay, whatever. You know, but it's not just whatever, because deforestation contributes more to the greenhouse gases in our atmosphere than all of the business and industry in the world and all of the transportation in the world put together. So those are like 2 huge sections of the world, the transportation section, the planes, trains, automobiles, and all the industrial factories and all the industrial cement making and all that stuff in the world. You add those two together, and their contribution is roughly the same to changing our atmosphere as what we're doing by cutting down the forests. So that's a big one. And the other thing it does is when we cut down the forests, each giant tree is like a huge water pump, pumping millions of gallons of water back in the atmosphere. Supposedly, now, I haven't verified the calculation. It seems hard to believe, but from a very reputable source, it says that each giant mature tree, whether it's pine needles or leaves, has the same evaporative surface area on as a 40-acre lake. So it's like each of those trees acts like a water pump. It sucks water out of its roots from the soil, out its needles and leaves, evaporates back in the atmosphere, and that water goes downstream and falls as rain. Now, what happens when you cut down all those trees is you get something called desertification downwind. It changes the weather patterns. So if you go to look at Iraq and Iran and the Middle East, well, those were like the Garden of Eden 5,000 years ago. It's called the Fertile Crescent. It's where humanity and civilization blossomed 5,000 years ago. And it was such a wonderful climate that people made lots of babies, and they farmed land, they cut the trees down, and when they cut all the trees down to build ships for the Phoenicians and charcoal and houses for people, well, it changed the weather, and the Fertile Crescent is now a desert wasteland. So that's problem number four. And problem number five is a combination problem. It's called the food crisis in the world. And see that we've had this population in the year 1800, or 1830, was like roughly a billion people in the world. Well, by the end of this year, we're coming up, we're supposed to pass 7 billion. So that's like seven times we've increased our population. Well, that increase of seven times has taken its toll on the planet. And the way we've kept up with that is the Green Revolution. We've been farming, and we've used artificial fertilizers and pesticides, and we've got fossil fuels to power our tractors, and we've transformed a lot of the planet from forests and natural habitat into farmland. And what's happening now is we're for the first time seeing decreasing returns. We're seeing climate change, we're seeing irrigation losses to farmland, we're seeing a water crisis, and we're seeing topsoils being depleted. So we're actually seeing the Green Revolution gains are starting to erode away and starting to go the other direction for the first time in hundreds of years. And with a population that's supposed to reach 9 billion people in the next 50 years, we're hitting the wall right now in a lot of directions. We got over a billion hungry people on the planet now. We're going to add 2 more billion people to the planet, and we're already crashing the systems. How are we going to do that?
Yeah, there's no doubt, and especially as we take a look, you know, at the inflation fears that are around the world right now, we see a lot of problems. You know, the percent of money that we actually spend on food out of our own income here in America is so drastically small compared to other countries that are much more poor. And these rising commodity prices are obviously aggravating these problems that you're already talking about. Well, we have a food crisis, we have a water crisis. And you know, Matt, I was watching a documentary the other day on the water crisis. That is of particular interest to me. And I don't think that people fully realize the impact of what our global water crisis is actually going to wreak upon future generations.
Yeah, it's major. We have aquifers, they're called fossil water. So, for instance, the big Oglala aquifer that irrigates land throughout the Midwest and Texas and Kansas and Arkansas, you know, those areas, Midwest and the United States, the big breadbaskets of the United States, which is also kind of a breadbasket of the world, and the breadbaskets of India and the breadbaskets of China. And between those two, they have over a third of the population of the world. Well, all of these major breadbaskets are using water unsustainably, meaning that they're pumping these aquifers dry. Now, in India, there's wells now where just one generation or two generations back, the farmers would dip their buckets with handheld buckets and ropes into these wells to irrigate their crops and to get drinking water for their family. Now they're finding with tube wells drilled down and electric pumps, they're having to go a mile deep. So here they were 20 foot deep, they had the water just a generation ago. Now they're running dry at a mile deep. And the same thing's happening in China. Beijing's aquifer is just going away at a rapid rate. The largest construction project in the world is to bring a river of water from 1,000 miles away from Beijing to Beijing, so that they can have water, because this giant population has just sucked the aquifer dry, and it's just about gone right now. So they're going at warp speed to bring this river 1,000 miles away to Beijing so they can have water. And we're running into these limits to growth all over. So Einstein has been quoted as saying that insanity, he defines a definition of insanity as doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. So what I'm saying is not that these aren't solvable problems, because they are solvable problems in my mind, but what I'm saying is that if we keep doing the same thing, business as usual, without a doubt, I am 100% certain that we will collapse the natural systems of the world and that the financial systems of the world will follow the natural systems. They can't exist in a vacuum without the natural systems, and that the business and financial systems of the world will collapse, the civilizations will collapse, and most of the people will go away. Now, that doesn't mean that as human beings, we can't take the bull by the horns and say, look, we are intelligent species. We can change. We can acknowledge we have a problem and do something different. You know, when Hitler threatened the United States and Japan, you know, bombed Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt went to Detroit and he called all the big guns in from Detroit and he said, gentlemen, this is a do or die situation. Within a year's period of time, I don't want a single automobile being manufactured and sold for domestic use. You will be behind the war effort 100%. And he set targets that everyone thought were totally unachievable and unrealistic. And not only was every single one of those targets achieved, in several cases they were far achieved. They were far exceeded the targets. So this is a situation we're in now where if we keep pretending that it's not happening, then as Einstein says, we will get the same result. And all of these six graphs are headed for the bottom. They're headed for the brick wall. And we will hit that brick wall. But if we take the bull by the horns and wake up and say, you know, the whole reason for our society is to serve the people of the world and the planet of the world, and there's no profit to be made in a dead planet, gentlemen. So if we don't take the bull by the horns and change this, there's not going to be any profit around. There's not going to be any stock market, and most of us won't be around much longer.
Well, Matt, and what I like about in the book is that you don't just belabor the problems as so many people do. I tell you, many people are experts at the problem, and they beat us over the head with the problems, and still I don't think many people understand what the true problems are. So in one way, it's good. We have to have people who understand the problems. But what I like about your book is that not only do you explain the problems, but then you take a lot of time in this very large book, and you explain what to do about it. You know, many people get bogged down in hearing about something and then they want to debate it, or they want to basically have an intellectual jousting match. But here in this book, what you do is you provide solutions. And
right.
So let's move right to some solutions right now, because I can think about people who are, you know, sitting in their living rooms listening to this program or in their car, and they're thinking, okay, you know, we got deforestation, we have the oceans are collapsing. Okay, well, what does that mean to me? So let's bring it down to a worst case scenario, and let's just take an example of me being in my home. I'm in my home, and let's say that the worst case scenario, there is a terrorist attack, or there is a massive natural disaster like an earthquake or one of these superstorms, and it comes and it knocks out the power grid in my area, and it's out for several days or even more. Okay, at that level, at that personal level, Matt, what would you do and what do you recommend in your book for such a circumstance? Because we know those things happen. They happened in Hurricane Katrina. They've happened around the country and other parts of the world. What do we do in a case like that where the grid goes down and all of the conveniences of life are gone in the blink of an eye?
Well, hopefully you planned ahead. But you know, my book helps people to deal with it on multiple levels. So there's a chapter on supplies and preparations, and they're very practical. So it's kind of like, how do you deal with your personal world, you, yourself, your family, your neighbors? How do you plan ahead? How do you deal with it? If you haven't planned ahead and things have fallen apart, how do you purify water the old-fashioned, low-tech ways? How do you scavenge for food? How do you hunt for food? If you planned ahead, how do you grow large amounts of food in a small area? You know, how do you what should you do in terms of a generator? Now, a generator is a great thing to have on hand for backup power. But, of course, if it's a long-term problem, then you're going to run out of gas for your generator and it won't do you much good. And then there's a chapter on renewable energy and solar work. So there's a whole variety of solutions that I offer, from, you know, storing food, how to store food, what types of food last a long time, what are the shelf lives, you know, how do you preserve food so the bugs don't get to it and it doesn't go rancid, all of those sorts of things. So in the grid thing, then there's the question of, well, are you in a cold climate? You know, do you have a backup source of heat? If you don't have a backup source of heat, how do you drain your plumbing in your house? How do you find and purify water? So, for instance, in the water thing, well, you know, if you've got a spring nearby, great, but most of us don't have that. I do recommend specific backcountry water filters to have on hand in your grab-and-run kit so that you can purify 100 gallons a day if you wanted to by hand-pumping water through these filters, and it'll take the bacteria out. But let's say you don't have one of those. You know, it's like everything's kind of falling apart. You didn't have the filter. Well, you can take, I mean, you can boil water, and that will kill any organism except for mad cow disease called prions, which most of us aren't eating cow brains, so we don't have to worry about that one. But say you don't have anything around, but there's some ditch water with some yucky water in it, and you don't want to get sick from drinking the ditch water, but you got nothing coming out of the tap. Well, if you can scavenge up some clear water bottles, you know, like bottled water bottles that are just empty, and you fill those with water, and they teach this to the people in the villages in Africa. You fill these bottles with water, and you tilt them on their side and lay them out in the direct sunlight. After 6 hours of direct sun, the UV rays in the sun have purified it, killed the bacteria and viruses inside those bottled water bottles. And it takes 2 days if it's cloudy weather and 6 hours if it's a half a day, basically, if it's a sunny weather. Now, if it's raining, well, you know, take those bottles and collect some rainwater instead, because the sun's not going to purify the rainwater through the not enough UV rays to do it, but there'll be nice, pure rainwater to collect in those scavenged water bottles anyways, and that'll do it. So I have, like, a wealth of information in my book on every, you know, how to deal with it, what kind of high-tech gadget should I have on hand in case things are down for a while, and how do I do things the old-fashioned, low-tech way if, like, everything's really down and all my high-tech gadgets are busted or gone, or I didn't think ahead and never bought any of them, you know, what do I do?
Matt, you know, I'm thinking about Y2K, and there was a large scare. There were canned goods and freeze-dried, you know, I'm sure there's still boxes and boxes and boxes of old food in people's garages from the Y2K scare. And I'm sure that there's a lot of people today who might be listening to you, maybe saying, you know, what is this all about? I mean, the grocery stores are always full every time I go. You know, I have clean water coming out of my tap. This message may be relevant to somebody living over in a village in Africa, as you mentioned, but it's not relevant to me. And I know you've made a lot of good points here with the six trends.
Well,
but what do you say to that? What do you say to that listener out there who says, "Look, I've heard this before. I've heard about the Y2K scare, and you know, this isn't important to me, or this is not relevant to me." What do you say to somebody who says that?
Okay. Well, personally, I never thought Y2K was going to do anything. And even though I'd received the inspiration, the cosmic download to write my book before Y2K, and if I'd written it right before Y2K, I mean, I probably could have made a lot of money, but it didn't come out till like 9 months later. And but that was a really easy problem to solve. It was just a couple of stupid bits on a computer system, and there was so much money at stake, and it was so easy to generate a technological solution around that. That was really a no-brainer almost. But what we're talking about now is natural systems of the planet that are in trouble, and I think everybody who opens their eyes can see at least most of these are really in trouble, and know that there is no snap of the finger easy solution to these problems. These are like really big problems that just aren't going to go away. You know, we can't count on the Star Trek dilithium crystals to get discovered and bail us out with this magical new energy source that will make everything good and wonderful. And I didn't see God come down and swoop down on the world and prevent the Nazi Holocaust or prevent the Rwanda Holocaust. And it didn't save the Easter Islanders from destroying their natural systems, and 90% of them starved, you know, 800 years ago when they cut down all the trees in their island and their population grew to the point where they overshot the ability of the island to support them. You know, God didn't come down and save them. They just ate each other and fought each other, and 90% of them went away. So this is something that's real. Now, I can't tell you if it's going to be next week or next month or in 10 years. I can tell you, it's going to be, unless I die really young and really soon, I'm going to see it, and most of us will. Now, insurance. You know, we buy insurance for cars. How many of us step into our car and say, gee, I think I want to get in a head-on collision today? It's like, no, you know, you buy your insurance, you pray to God you never need it, you hope you never use it, but you, you know, somebody is talking on the cell phone and runs that stop sign and slams into you and you thank God you got that insurance. Well, this is what I'm talking about here. If you got my book and you got that information at your fingertips, you may say this month, well, I'm just going to do some basics. I'm going to put together a quick grab and run kit for myself and my family so I get my, you know, my you-know-what is covered if some little something happens. But maybe in 6 months' time, Pakistan and India throw some nukes at each other and you think, oh, my God, the systems of the world are going to shut down in a hurry and I better run down to Costco and get a year's worth of food right now. You got my book on your shelf. You pull it down. You go to the worksheet on that year's worth of food. You jot down some numbers really fast and you rush right out because you know everybody else is doing the same thing. But you got the information. You know what to get. You're going to beat the crowd and you're going to get stuff to help you and your family that other people haven't got a clue to get because you got the information at your fingertips. I hope it never happens. I hope we figure this all out, and I hope, you know, I hope the Tooth Fairy comes down and saves our world. I wish it'll happen that way. I do believe, you know, when I give talks to crowds of people, and they ask, I ask people to raise their hands, how many of you think that everything's going to be fine? It'll be like 70 people, 80 people there, 100 people. It's like, nobody's hand comes up. One or two comes up. How many people think no matter what we do that everything's going to fall apart? And, you know, maybe 20%, 20% maybe raise their hands. And then how many, and then I say, well, how many of us think that we're going to get slapped around real hard and wake up and make the major changes and that we stand a chance of changing this? And my hand comes up, and so does about three-quarters of the people in the crowd. And they basically all think that we're going to get slapped around pretty badly and that we hope that things don't fall apart so fast that we can't kind of fix things and get our act together and prevent it from being too bad. And that's like... And I'm starting to call myself an optimistic doomer because I raise my hand in that group that thinks that maybe we stand a chance of getting slapped around and making the changes and it won't be too bad. And the true doomers is that 25% or so that raise their hand and think no matter what we do, it's going to all fall apart because we've gone too far and we've destroyed the systems of the planet and people aren't going to change and they're going to do the same thing and we're going to take it down.
Well, and that's exactly what we see right now on a global level and the fact that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of problems, as you're pointing out. And if we saw some sort of policy moves that were indicating to us that the leaders who were supposed to lead us actually saw that these problems were big enough to deal with, or if the people themselves demanded, which they should, that the policymakers deal with these things, then we might have an encouraging sign. But what we see right now is a massive, massive petroleum issue. Obviously, I'm sure, you know, tonight is the State of the Union with President Barack Obama. We don't know what he's going to talk about energy in a very positive way, or if it's going to be the same old, as we've heard out of our leaders for years, that there just simply does not appear to be any type of sustainable energy policy that can take us into the future, especially as we continue to grow the global population. So there doesn't seem to be any type of real policy responses to these things.
They just
keep coming in waves at us, and people are becoming almost numb to them. And so eventually, as you're saying, things are going to begin to fail. And of course, at that time, the Band-Aids will break out. At that time, they'll try to do something. But at that point, it will be too late. We'll have to go through and sacrifice and have the problems. This stuff is showing up too, Matt, in the economy. Because the problems that we have in oil roll right over to, you know, ExxonMobil. They roll right on over to the economy. The problems we have with rare earths, you know, all of these different type of minerals and things that come out of the ground, all of our natural resources, the food, all that's tied to the economy. Let's talk about the economy for a minute. This is an economic show. We talk about geopolitics and economics. You have also quite a bit to say about how this impacts the economy itself. What's your read right now on what the type of trends that you're seeing right now out there, the six that you mentioned, how are these impacting the economy from your perspective, and where is it leading over the next 2 to 3 years?
Well, it's totally, well, look at it. 2006, the world peaked in production of classic, easy-to-get sweet crude oil. Now, tar sands is like really horrible in the environment, costs a huge amount of money to process, and they're economically viable when gas gets over like $60 a barrel or something. They weren't viable when gas was 10 years ago, it was $10 a barrel. Now, so 2006 it peaks, then what happens? Oil prices start rising. 2008, they had almost $150 a barrel. The world economy collapsed. It could not stand it. Everyone said there's bubbles. What really drove the bubble is what really was like the straw that broke the camel's back was oil trading at $150 a barrel. It was costing too much to fly airplanes. Businesses, everything depending on oil was losing money. And everything was going into a tailspin, and then the bubble burst. Oil went from $150 a barrel to $35 a barrel in 3 months' time. Because the and then by then, though, the damage was done. The bubble had burst. The economy couldn't handle it. So that's number one. I mean, you're looking at the industry, the insurance industries of the world are basically looking at climate change and saying, you know, we're gonna go belly up. We're going to go bankrupt. If climate change continues like the scientists say, there's an MIT study that said that the computer models now are indicating it's a lot worse than we thought. That even if we do the best that the governments are projecting right now, we're talking about like a 6 degree centigrade, almost 10 degree Fahrenheit drop, rise in the next like 50 years to 100 years on this planet. And that means that the breadbaskets of the world are fried. They're toast. Where we get our food from is gone. So it's like all these systems are going to crash. And when they crash, the economy crashes. So you're looking at, you're looking at some major roller coaster ride in the next, in the next decade, and how we come out of that really depends a lot on if we start taking the bull by horns and start making the major changes that are required, not just lip service, not this little like, oh, let's do a few more, hybrid cars and it'll all be better. Well, hybrid cars are great. But our solutions have to be much bigger and broader than just, making 5% of the fleet in the world hybrid cars. It's just, that's not going to solve it for us. So we're looking at some rough times. We're looking at some opportunities for investors, obviously, in the short term for investing in technologies that are more sustainable and that will help people deal with and cope with these changes.
All right, let's talk about some of those, Matt. What are some of the areas that you see that could potentially provide investors with a nice return based upon the trends?
There's the alternative energy stuff and the things that make, in other words, there's still a lot of oil in the earth. So those technologies that help enhance the oil recovery, the EOR, enhanced oil recovery methods, those things that basically allow people to go back to depleting oil wells and get more out of the ground, those kinds of things that will help remediate the bioremediation technologies in the world, that will help remediate the toxics in the world, that will help stabilize carbon. There is a company called Calcera that makes a carbon-negative concrete. And concrete is like a very carbon-intensive process the way we make it right now. They take limestone and they heat it up with a huge amount of energy, and it calcines the limestone, burns off the water, goes away, it chemically changes, and you get cement out of it. And that cement is the glue inside of concrete, is the cement. And right now it's 10% of the global greenhouse gases in the world roughly are made from concrete production in the world. And there's a company that has taken... It's called biomimicry. In other words, it looks at how nature makes limestones, which is kind of like natural cement, and it's got these ingredients from the ocean. And so this company has sort of biomimicked that process and made a way of making cement that's actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere more than is generated in making the cement. So it's carbon negative. So all these technologies that are ways of actually changing our course from collapse to sustainability, ways of turning the Titanic from the iceberg. It's like we're on the Titanic headed for the iceberg. So the key technologies of the future are those things which will start heading us in the right direction where we're actually repairing the natural systems of the world instead of depleting and using them up and destroying them. And so that's where like there's key investment opportunities. And of course the other areas is in those businesses that will help sort of band-aid businesses that will help people cope with climate change and natural disasters and putting together pieces when things are falling apart. You know, those are areas which will indirectly be a positive area to invest in.
Matt, let's go back for a minute and talk about the grab and go bag that you were talking about, or what you call the separate. What did you call it again?
Sometimes it's called a 72-hour survival kit, a grab and run kit. It's basically what you and your family need for that critical 72 hours or 3 days after disaster. Now, obviously, you know, in many cases it could be longer than that, but it's something that you can pick up and throw in your car, or if necessary, put in a backpack and put on your back and hoof it down the road. And it's got to cover your food, your shelter, your clothing, and your water and your medicines for you and your family for those first three critical days when, you know, after most disasters, it's at least 3 days before the authorities, the National Guard, whatever kind of gets its act together and gets organized and gets there. Now, Hurricane Katrina, it was a little more than 3 days. Kobe, Japan, it was as long as 9 days for some of those people. So if you can have at least a couple weeks or a month's worth of food on hand in your home, that's terrific. And like I said in my book, I don't have a year's worth of food on hand right now, but, you know, that day may come when I decide to stop procrastinating. You know, I got a month, but that day may come in the near future where I run down and use my own worksheet and my own book to write up a list and just say, you know, I got to do it. I got to do it now. I got to do it before it's gone, and I got to buy it. So it's the 72-hour kit. Here's some few critical items in here. This is things that people don't think about. Now, on my website, wentechsales.com, I've got about 30 items listed for this kit, but I'll give you a few items that most people don't think about. Number one, most important, a water filter, a backcountry water filter. I design these things for a living. I like the Katadyn and MSR water filters. They got a carbon core, ceramic cleanable, field serviceable outside that filters out all the bacteria and most of the viruses out of the water. And the carbon core sucks out like nasty chemicals. You know, you have petrochemicals, you're living off the Mississippi River and a flood has flooded some chemical plant. The carbon core will suck out the bad tastes and odors and the nasty chemicals, and the outside ceramic part will filter out the nasty bugs. Most of us could live a month without food. You may not believe it, you may not feel good, and you certainly won't feel good, but you could do it. But without water and hot temperatures, 3 days, people start dying. 1 day without water, you're absolutely miserable. And if it's really hot, like Arizona desert hot, and you have to be physically active to get yourself somewhere, you could die in a single day without water.
Not just water, but also you got to have clean water.
That's right.
And these Katadyn water filters that you're talking about, I'm familiar with those and I own one. These things are pretty amazing. You go out now, you can pretty much go to any source of water, I guess, except barring the ocean. What are some of the areas that you can actually use these Katadyn water filter, or any water filter for that purpose?
A good water filter, you should be able to stick it into a scummy green duck pond and get clean, good-tasting, safe drinking water out of that scummy duck pond or ditch. That's what you need. Now, there's a great gadget to supplement that with called a SteriPen. And a SteriPen is like a little, you know, you might remember that movie, The Men in Black, where, you know, the little aliens are running around. The guy pulls out his pen and says, "Gentlemen, take a look here, please." Takes out his eyeglasses, puts them on, just holds the pen up, gives it a click, the light flashes, poof, and everybody's memory's gone. Well, a SteriPen's kind of like that. You take your SteriPen out, you stick it into your bottle of water, you give a click, and the light flashes, poof, for about 10 seconds. It's the blue light, it's a sterilizing UV light, and all the bugs are dead. Here's the downside to the SteriPen. Downside is got to be clean water. If it's scummy water, and then all bets are off because the bugs will hide behind the scum in the water and the light won't get to all the bugs and you'll still get sick. Now, if you drink bad water and all of a sudden you're vomiting and you got diarrhea, well, you're going to lose a lot more bodily fluids than that water you just drank, and you're going to contribute to dehydration and taking yourself down faster than if you hadn't drunk that water to begin with. So that's why water is so valuable. The number two important item in there is a little first aid kit, and this is super important. I always supplement my little first aid kit. Now, I actually have two first aid kits in my grab and run box. I have a big blue tub, And in that tub, I've got a giant comprehensive river guide first aid kit where I could, like, I have hemostats, I could clamp off a vein, I could stitch up a leg, I can do all kinds of things if I had to. And then I got a little compact, fits in the palm of my hand first aid kit. So if I'm in, earthquake country and wildfire country, so if a big earthquake hits in the summertime, then bridges will go down, pipes will burst, gas lines will burst, fires will start out. And if it's summertime and it's heavy fire season, then all of a sudden I might have a fire coming down on me, and I've got to put things on my back and go out and cross the river or get myself in the middle of the river, and my car's not going to do me much good because the bridges are down. So I've got a grab-and-run kit, and I've had some of the items are doubled. I've got compact versions and heavy-duty versions, and if it goes on my back, then I got to take the little lightweight one because, you know, carrying some food and other things is more important than a giant first aid kit. But if it's going in my car or my truck, then the whole tub goes in there with the whole shebang.
Well, Matt, and we actually talk about that. We have something called a go bag. It's very similar, you know, 3 days supplies. And, you know, people think, well, gosh, you know, when am I actually going to need that? I mean, if your house burns down, you know, you can always go run and grab your go bag. You could have documents in there like your copies of your passport, copies of your, you know, driver. You know, these are just important things.
That's correct.
That many people just don't think about. They think that it has to be an absolute extreme event that they would ever need something like that. But I tell you, the grab bag, the go bag, just one of the most vital things. In fact, we have 5 levels to financial freedom here at our organization. And in level 1, we say, create a go bag.
Oh, yeah?
It's one of the very first things. Before you bother going out and buying stock and before you go out and try to buy gold, look, just kind of cover the basics. And creating a go bag, you know, and you provide that material on your website. You have it in your book as well. You know, one of the things I like about this as well is that you also talk about the importance of having a family emergency plan. So many times we don't even think about that. We think we've got all of our bases covered. Maybe we've bought a few extra cans of beans from the store. We've got a, you know, a few extra jugs of water. We feel like we're pretty prepared. But what about a family emergency plan? What is a family emergency plan, and what kind of things should it cover?
Sure. Well, I've got a whole checklist, and certainly number one on there is getting your 70 your grab and go kit right there. But number 2 is like getting a meeting place. Say you guys are separated and the phones aren't working, then you know that, say it's a, you know, maybe it's a local high school athletic field, whatever, a place where if you're separated and can't reach each other, that you're all going to go collect, you know, and say then you want to make sure all your members of your family know how to shut off the power and the water and the gas to your home in the case that something's going on and you don't want to start a fire. You want to have a spare key stashed somewhere outside your home so that you can operate a car if for some reason your home is burning down or falling down or whatever, that you can get in your cars. You know, I live in snow country, and one day we got shook out of bed at about 5 in the morning and in the middle of winter, and it's about 0 degrees outside, and we're running around with our birthday suits, and there was a 5.5 earthquake centered 3 miles from our home. And, boy, it felt like a truck had just backed into the home. And if it had been a point harder and the home was falling down around us and we ran outside, you're stuck in the middle of winter. You don't have some spare clothes and some keys. You know, you're going to be SOL. It's going to be a really tough time for you and your family out there in the snow in your birthday suit or your undies in the middle of winter. So, you know, having these are all part of the checklist in the on the family plan, and there's getting CPR training and first aid training for members of your family, an out-of-state emergency contact. You know, maybe the local phone lines are down, but you can call Mary Sue, you know, Aunt Sue in Kansas City, and you can all, like, try to coordinate through her. If you can't call locally, often in disasters, you can find someone and you can get a call out of the area. Not always, but sometimes. You know, there's no one thing that will apply in every situation. So you want to have flexibility and a variety of tools at your fingertips.
Well, I want to say we have one more question for you, Matt, but I want to say at this point I'm thinking about this. If there's anybody listening to this at this point and is not thinking about the need to prepare or is seeking wisdom right now on how to make preparations in the event of something that is devastating. I got to tell you, I feel sorry for you. I feel sorry for you if you don't understand the need to prepare after hearing all of this, because I tell you what, the people who don't see the need to prepare, I think what they think in their mind, Matt, is the government is going to take care of them. that there's some sort of social safety net that's going to come to their rescue because they don't have to prepare because somebody else is going to prepare for them because for whatever reason. And I got to tell you, it's those kind of people that get slaughtered in the stock markets. It's those kind of people who get slaughtered in everyday life. And especially if we have a major disaster coming, if that were to happen, and the people who do not prepare think the government is going to help them, they are sorely mistaken. I mean, completely mistaken. We see evidence, obviously, of that in Hurricane Katrina. Matt, is the government of the United States going to be able to help Americans if they don't prepare?
It will only for the small ones. You know, when the big things happen, like 5 years after Katrina, a lot of those people are still in sore shape. You know, we just saw that. Kobe, Japan, whenever it's massive, no, the government is overloaded and it can't handle it. You know, here we think we're the ones helping out the entire world. Well, you know, when Hurricane Katrina happened, there was other countries coming to help us out. And even then, 5 years later, we're still in problems. So we're talking about these six trends. We're talking about things that will make Katrina look like a veritable picnic, unfortunately. And I wish I could think it was different, and I hope it's different, but I don't honestly believe it's going to. I think it's going to make Katrina look relatively easy. Because in Katrina, when it hit, you could at least drive a couple hundred miles and get out of it. There's things that are coming down the pipeline that will be really, really hard to just get away from and get out of it. And so preparing and being self-reliant, and that's where your neighbors and your friends and your community is very important. Because when disaster strikes, it's often your neighbor and your friend that you're relying on, because the authorities and the central systems and the government are just totally overloaded and don't know what to do and can't get there and totally disorganized. And if you're counting on them in that situation to come and make it all better for you, then you're going to be in bad shape.
We have about time for about one more question here, Matt. And I want to ask you, because you hinted at it in that last answer, what are some of the things that people can be doing at the community level to help prepare for a devastating event?
Well, there's I talk about that in my book. There's sort of like the micro level, which is you and your family, and there's the macro level, which is like the world and large scale in dealing with the six trends, and then there's the community level. And in the community level, there's several things, and there is another book I'd like to recommend, and I do talk about it in my book, but there's another one, if you're real interested, called The Transition Handbook. And it talks about developing resilient systems on a community level. So you can do things like you can have energy co-ops where the community starts developing the ability to generate its own power, whether it's through windmills and solar farms or biofuels and you know, like a wood chip plant, et cetera. So you start having some stability and strength. So if the grid, say, did go down, you could unhook from it locally and at least supply, you know, a few hours a day or whatever of power locally to help people maintain a reasonable existence. There's trade and barter. There's local currencies. There's some, you know, you have a thing called the local multiplier effect. So when you spend money in your community, then that guy, you know, say he's in a part of a local energy co-op and you're actually generating power that's used locally, at least part of the power that's used locally is generated locally, then that guy gets a salary and he goes to the restaurant and he buys food in the restaurant, and she gets a salary and she goes and buys clothes at the store next door, and et cetera. So the multiplier effect keeps that money circulating in your community. So these transition communities are sort of planning to relocalize, to have resilient systems locally, to start making things locally and buying things locally, so that when, you know, if the big machine of the big global distribution of the world's sources and goods and all that stuff starts shaking up and not working so well, then at least you have some local systems set up that will survive and will manage and will keep things going on a local level. So building that resilience locally is so important to be able to deal with this peak in world oil production and to start relocalizing and developing the ability to provide food and to make and manufacture and repair things locally and grow and you know, keep a civilization going without having to get everything from China, you know, or India, or, you know, all the way across, get your blueberries from Chile and your shoes from the Philippines and all of that.
Well, Matt, I really appreciate your time coming on Follow the Money Weekly. Matt, by the way, has authored a book called When Technology Fails. You can read his guest columns on Huffington Post. You can see him on Fox News. He's a regular contributor on the radio and TV media. But I want to thank you for coming on the program. I really appreciate all the insights that you've shared. If people are interested in finding out more about you and your work, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, go to my website, www.whentechfails.com, whentechfails.com. And if you click on the articles, you'll find there's a wealth of totally 100% free information that will help you out with a lot of this. Naturally, a lot more in the book, but that gives you a great start. And you can click on the audio and video interviews if you want to hear more about what I've said. And I like to leave people with my motto. And my motto is, I urge everyone to do their best to change the world and do their best to be ready for the changes in the world. And thank you so much for having me on today.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Matt. We'll have you back on soon. God bless you.
All right. Take care.